session number 14582, Reel 7.
Stephen Dale, Reel 7.
There were one or two other occasions when we all met together. One was All Saints Day, a Catholic holiday, when they first of all asked me whether I wanted to go to the church service, and I said yes, not for any religious reasons, but because it makes a change to get out of your cell. And that's where I met Charles Barker and Peter Priestley again. On one occasion, when coming back from an interrogation, there was a nun walking down the spiral staircase. And she asked me a question in Italian, to which I simply answered, I don't know, I don't speak Italian. So she said, what are you? And I said, British. And she sort of raised her hands and said, un inglese, and disappeared. Well, I thought it was an interesting incident. But that night, my cell door clanged open, and one of the relatively friendly Italian boarders stood in the door, held the cell door open. In came the nun, clutching her apron to her chest, walking up to my bunk, opening it up, and out tumbled four bread rolls, and she immediately turned round and disappeared again. And I thought that was one of the most encouraging things that ever happened to me. I thought it was absolutely marvelous. Food was scarce. And in circumstances like that, one seems to concentrate more on food. I had a mania for keeping fit. And then I discovered that I could use the beautifully whitewashed wall to make an encyclopedia. And with that, a little stub of pencil which I had, I wrote onto the whitewashed wall under lots and lots of headings anything I could think of. Flowers, names of countries, generals, the 48 states of the United States, rivers, mountains, writers, composers, whatever you can think of. And in time, I really covered the wall. And the prison authorities brought in visitors to show my encyclopedia on the wall. I resented it, but what the hell could I do? Another thing that happened at intervals was that in that landing between the two rows of cells facing each other on my floor, they would bring in periodically groups of 20, 30, or 40 Yugoslav partisans or Yugoslavs that were on their way to Germany or to Austria, into labor camps. And when they looked into the cell and saw me there, they were, of course, curious, because one's got to remember that British had a very good press in those days in Yugoslavia, because we were really trying to be helpful to them in their pursuit of their anti-German activities. And they would start talking to me there. And then they would put money onto the cell door. And I used to shove it back because, I didn't want their money, and therefore I felt they needed it themselves. And then they would put cigarettes or tobacco under them, which I also didn't want, but I accepted it. But in the morning, after lights out, of course, all these activities ceased. And lights out was at 9 o'clock. In the morning, when they'd gone, the corridor between the two cells was empty, but on the inside of my cell door, there was money and tobacco. And That happened several times. I then had a problem. If I wanted to smoke, how am I going to light my cigarettes if using newspaper to roll my cigarettes? And I forget who taught me the trick, but it was quite a laborious one. But then I had plenty of time on my hand. Among the things which the Germans did not fail to take of me was a razor blade, and also I discovered that I had a lighter flint. Now I should add here that I didn't have a toothbrush, and I was clamoring for a toothbrush. And one day somebody brought me a toothbrush, but of course it had been used. So I mean, I washed it as well as I could at the single tap at the end of the corridor, and then I had a toothbrush. But the toothbrush served another purpose. If one takes a little bit of newspaper and then the razor blade and shaves off the handle, some sort of shavings off, I think it must have been celluloid in those days, and puts those in a little heap onto the newspaper, and then takes the flint, which I had, and inserts it into the end of the little stub of pencil, and uses the razor blade to strike sparks from the flint onto the little heap of toothbrush shavings on the newspaper, eventually it would set fire to them. And that's how I lit my cigarettes. Incidentally, with the money they left behind, I bought tobacco from the warders, and no doubt paid through the nose for it. I wasn't dependent on smoking, but I mean anything to while the time away. So the other thing I needed badly was warmth. And every scrap of newspaper I could lay my hands on, I used to put between my skin and my shirt to create an extra layer for warmth. And also between the two thin blankets I had on my so-called bed. But it did get very cold towards the end of November. There's a wind coming down from the mountains called the Bora, and that's a cold wind. And I got chilblains on my hands again, as I did before in Sachsenhausen. And in time, these chilblains cracked. I never got chilblains on my feet. I asked for the doctor at the Coroneo. After repeated requests, he turned up and I showed him my hands. And he said, there's nothing I can do except to tell you that the rains of May, of the month of May, will cure your chilblains. Well, he was right, in fact, but it wasn't very pleasant all the same. In the cells on my floor were sort of heavy political cases, and many of them disappeared, and they overnight sometimes. And when you ask the warder in the morning what happened to so-and-so in that cell over there, he would simply say, shot, fucilato. And none of it was very encouraging, nor was the fact that I'm on a scrap of newspaper, which I found on the landing, I saw a report, Italian newspaper, I saw a report that some British officers had been shot in the Milan region for sort of reprisal for some partisan activities. Christmas, we were allowed to visit Bill in the hospital. And this was really one of the most macabre occasions, because up there, they had so much to eat and drink. One's got to remember that anybody who had money could buy himself a place in the hospital. And so when we were allowed to visit Bill, I mean, we were roped into the festivities. That meant we had something, we got some extra food and drink. And there was one man, an Albanian black marketeer, immaculately dressed, who made zabaglione. Instead of using marsala, which normally goes into it, and sugar and eggs, he used stock brandy. But it didn't affect my enjoyment of it. It was really, but the whole, if one comes to think of this whole situation, it is so incongruous to see that, I mean, one sees that sort of thing in a film and we say, what a crazy idea. But it did happen. It was fun while it lasted, but it was also discouraging simply as a fact. In January, the four of us were taken by train from Trieste to Vienna, and we were handcuffed two and two together and marched by five German soldiers, one sergeant and four privates. We went by train. The train was very hot, but it suited us because, I mean, we really thawed out for the first time and we went through that wonderful snowy landscape towards Vienna. It was a very long journey, but it didn't worry us. And in Vienna, we had to change stations. And on the way, we stopped in the soldiers' canteen, which was thick with Germans or Austrian soldiers. And we sat at the table, and they all knew we didn't belong. but nobody batted an eyelid because we had these four, we were obviously guarded there. And we had what we termed at the time to be an excellent meal. It was hot, tasty. I don't know whether it was. It wasn't particularly good, but it was. It went down a treat. Now, Bill Smallwood couldn't walk properly. With this, he only had carpet slippers on, and by walking through the snow in Vienna was pretty awful. But that was nothing compared to the next day when we arrived on the last leg of this journey at the place called Kaiser Steinbruch, which was which was Stalag 17A. And that was an enormous place. Probably, I don't know, there were perhaps 50,000 people there, perhaps more, I have no idea. Predominantly Russians, Poles, Yugoslavs, Hungarians, and 200 British under ranks, for whom it was a Straflager. That means they had tried to escape at some stage or other, or guilty of some other misdemeanors. And we were in one cell about 10 feet by 12 feet or something like that. And there was a large bunk in there and a little stove. And apart from that, there wasn't much room. And that, at the end of that, one end was the door and the other end was a window, heavily barred. And the day we arrived, we sat there, a little relieved to be in the hands of the German army rather than in the hands of the SS. There was knocking, loud, energetic knocking on the window, and we opened it, and there were about half a dozen British other ranks telling us, full of excitement, A, they've heard we've arrived, B, that's nice, welcome, and all that sort of thing. And then they gave us the news. And they told us about the Ardennes offensive, hath come to grief, which pleased us no end, because it was the time when von Rundstedt was trying to break through to Antwerp. This was this the last fling, really, of the Germans. And they were so excited about it all. I mean, it was wonderful. And it sort of cheered us up immensely to get this group of young men, who some of them of the parachute regiment who had been taken prisoner at Arnhem. And that was a real morale booster for us. And the next day, the sergeant major came around to see us. He was the senior British officer at the camp, or senior British rank at the camp, talking to us, saying that, sorry, but I mean, there's very little I can do for you, gentlemen. But he got us a little bit more firewood, and that's about as far as he could go. The food was terrible. Food was incredibly bad. One Russian major came round with a cauldron of soup every day, which was really sort of coloured grey-coloured water with some cabbage leaves floating in it. And he wanted to sell a beautiful belt for some cigarettes. And I gave him some cigarettes, I forget, two or three, and he gave me that belt. And I had that belt for years until Joanna discovered it. Joanna's my elder daughter, and she fancied it, and so she had the belt. But that's a good many years ago. Then the Russians took Budapest, and three of us who were officers were removed from Kaiser Steinbruch. Charles Barker, being a sergeant, stayed behind. Charles eventually made his escape and went back to England, via Odessa, of all places. We were transported to Querum, which is outside Brunswick, off Lac 79. It took us 4 days to get there because, I mean, the trains were shot up by our own planes repeatedly, and so we were delayed. We didn't mind. In February, was it February? Yes, must have been second half of February, we arrived at Oflak 79, the three of us, and I was suddenly confronted with the need to establish my identity, because the inhabitants of Oflak 79 were predominantly British, and they wanted to know how we got there. Now, the others could establish their bona fides reasonably easily. I couldn't, because, I mean, I couldn't mention names of other people in regiments, or names of people, of masters at public schools and things like that, in order to to establish anything. Of course, Bill Smallwood was trying to be helpful, but it took a few days until I was told I was acceptable, not a plant by the Germans. Understandable, but I mean, I knew I wasn't a plant, they didn't. And so it had to be proved, and it was proved in the end simply by radio contact with London, which I knew existed. I never made it my business to try and find out, but I was cleared. For practical purposes, that meant I could listen to the news, to the news bulletins, you know, which were, as opposed to the German news, we had our own news bulletins. In the end, the Germans asked us for the news, you know. In one of the prison off Lac 79 at Querum was originally a Luftwaffe barracks, and they had enormous rooms downstairs, and in one of them there was a war map, which was probably 6-8 yards long. And when you looked at on that war map, we had the official German official front line in the corners with the German news, sort of shown in with coloured pins or pins with coloured heads. But we always, when we looked at the war map, we always were 2 or 3 foot further east than the line is depicted. On the 12th of April, 45, American tanks rolled into the camp. And that was a great moment. They were very depressed because Roosevelt had died that day. But it was never, they were marvelous to us. They were, of course, as victors, they were sort of on top of the wave, and they gave us everything they could do without. And we had, it was really a fantastic moment. For me, it was also significant in one respect, because suddenly this constant fear under which I've lived from the moment I was taken prisoner, that suddenly didn't exist anymore. Because I knew now that they won't discover my background. And which wouldn't have been beneficial for me. And that was a phenomenal relief. I think I ought to mention something else which I haven't alluded to yet. Before we were dropped in Italy, it was recommended that we might want, it was recommended that we should change our names again. And if possible, also have a cover story. Well, in the event, I chose as my name the name of a very good friend of mine called Tony Turner. I became Stephen Patrick Turner, brother of Anthony William Lionel Turner. And of course, Tony, who'd been the conscientious objector, didn't know about all this until after the war. No, until I was repatriated in April 45, when I met him again. He was absolutely tickled pink that I've chosen his name, despite the fact that the purpose why I did it was not one of which he approved. I mean, he was quite sort of, he understood my motives. He was a most serious conscientious objector in terms of he would speak for people at tribunals, but he would be careful to speak only for people where he was absolutely convinced that they were really conscientious objector and not trying to get out of military service for other reasons. And he maintained this record. I mean, everybody he spoke for got off. I remember I went with him to one of the tribunals. It was at Parsons Green or something like that in London. And it was quite impressive to see him. Not that there was great oratory required of him, but I mean, he was factual to the point, and it was clear that the chairman of the tribunal and the other people with him sort of paid attention to what he had to say. I mean, he obviously had established a good name for himself there. Tony was the organizer, I think it was called, of the Socialist Party of Great Britain. I think they exist today still, but I mean, they're completely unimportant in terms of effective in terms of party politics, active party politics. They regarded themselves to be the true inheritors of Marxism, as it should be taught. But of course, I mean, they're really a relic of the past. Tony was extraordinarily well known as a speaker in Hyde Park, and I mean, in fact, I mean, when you walked with him anywhere, and I mean, people would sort of greet him, and I mean, they may never have spoken to him, but they recognized him. And on the day war broke out, He spoke against the war without a microphone to an audience of 5,000 people, and it was quite something. Unfortunately, he too is dead. But then he was a bit older than I am.
If I could go back to this issue of your identity, this was a fear of yours then, during your interrogations particularly, that you would be, your true identity would be detected, is that right?
I was concerned that, naturally, I mean, I was concerned that my true identity should not be detected. But it wasn't just a question of identity. The simple fact that if I'd been recognized as a German Jew, that would have been enough without details of my identity to spell the end.
When you were being interrogated, particularly by the Gestapo, didn't they twig that you were German?
I spoke German to them.
Yes, so did they think that you were a Jew?
I mean, how come you speak such good German? It's very simple. I mean, I had a German mother, right? Where'd she come from? Cologne. Well, I knew that in Cologne most of the records had been destroyed. So...
had this been worked out before your drop, in the SOE training?
In my mind, yes. But that wasn't... we were not required to give chapter and verse of our cover story to anybody. And that makes sense, because for security reasons alone. Security was something which was very, very of paramount importance, but it was also something which came easily to me. I have no problem myself with any demands that were made or constraints imposed by security. I mean, I could cope with that quite easily. I had no difficulties at all. Other people did have. They couldn't keep their mouth shut, or they could, or they were not consistent in their attitude and sort of gave things away.
But would you say that being a member of SOE did create special difficulties?
They didn't know I was with SOE.
No, but being in SOE, I was thinking of the issue with the British, for instance, when, they were wanting to check up on your background and you couldn't give this. They know that you were... did you have to reveal to them that you were SOE? In the prison camp, when you were saying that the British were suspicious of you at once.
I don't remember when we probably didn't even say SOE. We probably just said what we were doing where.
and it would have been Royal Fusiliers, they would have known you as a Royal Fusilier, is that right?
By that time, I was no longer with the Royal Fusiliers. I was with something called General List. And the Germans wanted to know what does General List mean. They thought in terms of a German general named List, right? What does General List mean? So, I mean, the nearest thing I could think of was ZBV, which means in German, zur besonderen Verwendung. I mean, that were sort of special units, right? Okay. After all, if you're being dropped in or caught 180 miles behind the lines, that was where I was caught near Tolmezzo. The front line in those days was Rimini Forli, much further south in Italy. I think it was called the Gothic Line. So, I mean, they knew you were after something up there, and which wasn't sort of picking Edelweiss or something like that.